So, hi. I bring you greetings from the United States. From wow, okay, enthusiasm. I'll say this, and we'll see if we get the same response from Washington D.C. Yeah, nothing. I don't get anything for that. Right, and as I told the group this afternoon, one of the nice things about being a psychiatrist and living and working in Washington, D.C. is, you know, you'll never be out of a job. And grateful for all those elections that happen. People are anxious beforehand and depressed afterwards. I can't lose. It's just a big money-making operation for a psychiatrist. And I had the privilege of being here a few years ago. And I don't know if anybody here was here when I was here or not. You were. Oh, and you came back. It's nice. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for doing that. First of all, I just want to say thank you for welcoming me and for inviting me to be part of this. A couple things to start. My understanding is we're going to be done like around what time? 8:30, I'm done, right? And then Q&A. We're done at what time? Like, people are walking out the door at 9 o'clock, right? Whether I'm still talking or not, they're just leaving. All right, very good. Okay. So a couple things as we start. One is, we can have these conversations. I'd like for this to be a conversation, even though I know I'm going to yap for a while here. I'd like for this to be a conversation. And when we come to things like this, sometimes we come because we want to learn things that we can then take with us and apply, hopefully, immediately when we leave the building. Right? We want to learn things, and that's completely reasonable. But I want also to encourage us to consider this question, and that is, what is God wanting to do in the room right now? So it's not just a question of is this going to be an information download? I'm going to give you information. We'll somehow like take that out and apply that at some point in time. But what is God actually up to in the room at this very moment? What are we sensing? What are we feeling? What are we imaging? What are we experiencing? So that's one question that's important to know. Because I want to invite us to consider that if we believe the biblical narrative that the Trinitarian God was in this room waiting for us long before we showed up, because it is his total delight to be where we are. And if we were to read the Bible carefully, we would read about a God who would say, I can't believe I get to be your God. That's how he would begin. He wouldn't begin by saying, you need to think about how cool it is for me to be your God. He would begin by saying, I can't believe how cool it is for me to be your God. And that's where we begin. We begin with the notion that from the beginning, we were created for joy. Genesis 1. And God made this, and he made that, and he made this, and he made that, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And like a lot of really, really rich, good stuff. And joy was to be held. And then he gets to the very end of Genesis chapter 2, where he has already been down literally in the mud, right? Genesis 2, 7, and the Lord God formed the man from the dust of the earth, and he breathed the breath of life into man's nostrils, and man became a living being. But not before in Genesis 1, verse 26, where the text reads, and God said, let us make mankind in our image. So the first thing that we read in these foundational texts is that God's making us not first of all as individuals. He's first of all making us as a collective group of people. And that we don't ever experience joy apart from being in the presence of other people. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't experience joy by ourselves, but it means that joy is fomented, joy is encouraged, joy is experienced, it is created necessarily because of the presence and the interaction that we have with other people. Does that make sense? And then there's that other thing, too, that's going on, in Genesis 1:26, because if the text were to be consistent with the way the preceding text was written, we would think it would go something like everything else was written, right? It said, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let the, you know, the light and the darkness be separated from one another. And God said, let the land be separated from the sea, and let there be this, let there be that. You would think you'd get to 1:26, and it would say something like, and God said, let there be mankind on the earth, and there was mankind on the earth. But it doesn't say that. It says, and God said, let us make mankind. Right? It's as if he's going to have a conversation about it. It's as if he is wondering about it. Right? There you can imagine the Holy Trinity sitting around thinking about, like, is this a good idea? Right? And you can imagine Jesus saying, I'm not so sure it is. There's that whole Good Friday thing, and I'm not really sure I'm new. Right? But there's a sense in which when it's all said and done, we sense a God who thinks about everything that's coming and makes us anyway. Because he is this joyfully delighted to be our God. Not just to have us in the world, but to be our God. And so he forms us from the dust of the earth. So we are all these things, right? We are embodied creatures. We are relational creatures. And the current course of neuroscience and attachment research would tell us that if we're going to flourish, we need both our bodies and our relationships to be talking with one another really effectively. And then he gets to the end of Genesis 2, and this last verse, and it's all, you know, he's made man, and he brings woman out of man, and he brings the two together. And that last verse is that, and the man and the woman were naked and unashamed. Right? And the Hebrews had a range of language that they could use to describe what was going on in that moment, right? They could say the man and woman were naked and happy. The man and woman were naked and unafraid. The man and woman were naked and a whole range of different things. Why would they pick shame as the thing? They were unashamed. Well, why would they be naked? And helpful to know, too, that the implication of the Hebrew in that moment isn't so much naked is not just primarily referring to their physical status. It's not so much about sex or sexuality. It is about vulnerability. It is about what it means for us as human beings to be vulnerable people. Now, that's why we wear clothes, right? It's why we live in houses, right? No other animals on purpose put clothes on. We put clothes on animals. Like in the U.S., like why do they put coats on dogs? Like I don't, like the dogs, like if you ask the dog doesn't want to be in a coat, right? But we'll put coat on the dogs, right? Because we are vulnerable. And here's something that's important to know. We create most powerfully and most sustainably in states of vulnerability, creating with those who are absolutely different than we are, when shame does not have part of the conversation. Notice it. The text says it. The text does not say and the two human beings, right? It doesn't equalize these. The text is very clear. We've got two different genders, right? And we like to say in the business, right, that women and men have many things about us that are very similar. Our brains really aren't that different. I mean, you might beg to differ, but they're not that different in a lot of how they operate. And we've got two eyes and a nose and two ears and a mouth and two arms and two legs. There are a lot of things that we do very, very similarly. But the places where we are different, we are infinitely different. You want to talk about differences? In the U.S., you can talk about the North and the South, right? If anybody of you know anything about our history, right? Civil War. You can talk about racial differences. You can talk about blacks and whites, and every country has them. You can talk about the Arabs and Israelis. You can talk about any number of different people, right? My enemy, whoever that might happen to be, I will tell you, there is no demographic set of groups in the world that has had as long a history and track record of enmity between it than men and women. You with me? Right? Because the original texts go out of their way to say in Genesis 3, and he will be your master and your desire will be for him. And that word desire is not about sexual desire. That desire is about an undermining, right? This is about corrosion and erosion for consumption. Men and women from the very beginning, like Where we are different, we are infinitely different, and we are infinitely at war. And it is those two that are naked and unashamed, standing on the precipice of a vast potential for creativity. And this is the other thing that we were made to do. Like when God says in Genesis 1:26, let us make mankind in our image, God means like, let us make mankind to live like we live. And to live like we live doesn't just mean like just happen to be living on the earth. I've got a pulse and I've got a mouth and I eat and so forth. No, it is, I am commissioned to create. I am commissioned to create, and I've got multiple different vocational domains. And by vocation, I don't just mean like what you do to earn a living. I mean, what is God calling you to do as any number of different things? If you're a female, it means that you're somebody's daughter. So that's a vocation. You could be a sister. You could be a wife. You could be a mother. You're certainly a friend. You are a daughter of God. You could be a cyclist. You could be a painter. You could be an engineer. You could be a number of different things. And if you're a male, you could be all those things as well. Well, you wouldn't be somebody's sister, and you wouldn't be, you get what I mean, right? But we are multiple different things. And here's the thing. We were made to create in this way. We were made to create phones. But there's no shame in this, right? Because okay, so this is the thing. Why does the text say they were naked and unashamed? And I want to say this. Not just because the writer knows what's coming. That's part of it. But I want to suggest that the writer says this because there is no more primitive thing in the world that evil will use to wield to devour you than shame. Now, I understand that this community has suffered a great loss in the last week. Is that right? And can I just say, that is not the way it's supposed to be. And I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. It's a god-awful thing. And I would guess that the Trinity weeps far greater than we do even. And I just want to say I'm just really sorry. And you can't say you're sorry enough. So I was 17 when my father died of heart disease at age 62. And I lost one brother to cancer 12 years ago, and I lost another brother to cancer 3 years ago. And my parents were 45 when I was born, and which meant that I was going to funerals by the time I was 3. And so, like, death has been a commonplace thing for me, and it's never been very fun. About 12 years ago, in a span of 15 months, my wife and I lost 6 people, only one of whom died when they should have, at age 86, and that was my mother. Everybody else dying long before their time. And evil will wield it to remind us that we just aren't worth it, that we aren't enough. You see, grief, in its most fundamental aspect, is about shame. And why is that the case? Because in many respects, shame is this neurobiological event. It is, first of all, it is not this abstraction. We're going to talk about what it is in more detail in just a moment. It is not this abstraction. It is not an idea. It is not first and foremost like this thought that we have. It is a neurophysiologically encountered event that happens to your body. It can happen as early as 15 to 18 months of age in human beings. We pick up on it that soon. And so one of the reasons that I would suggest that the author of the Genesis text is using this language is because the author is pointing out that this is a really big deal. It starts early, it happens often, and it creates trajectories of human engagement that are awful, and death is how it uses itself most potently. Because in the end, part of what shame says to us is like, I am not powerful enough. I do not have what it takes. I am not enough to stop whatever is happening. And if there's anything else that can prove this, it's like when people die, particularly unexpectedly. Are you with me? And evil would like nothing more than just to remind us over and over and over and over, you can't stop this. You lost a 50-year-old member who was heroic. You can't stop this. I want to tell you, Jesus has something very different to say. But it's really hard to listen in the middle of grief. It's really hard to listen. So this notion that we were created for joy gets truncated. It gets sheared off pretty easily by events like this. Right on? And we wonder, where the heck is God when all this is happening? So, if you read the literature about shame, shame would answer that question. The literature would answer that question and say, God doesn't really have anything to do with this. Shame is just something that happens to be in the universe. It's just an artifact of what it means to be a biological being. Whether you believe in God or not, shame's going to happen. Our job is just to manage it. And there are some ways that we think about shame scientifically. This would be one thing to understand. If people here drive manual transmission automobiles, anybody here drive manuals? Okay, all right, so you know. All right, so, okay, great. Like, oh, good, yeah, right. No, please stand up. It's great. I was kidding. All right, okay. Just it doesn't take much to get you all excited here. Okay. But we're really happy for you. Right. What's your name? Julie. You get a door prize. Okay. At the end of the night. Right. Okay. So imagine if you're driving a standard transmission car, and my colleague Alan Shore at UCLA would describe it like this. If you're driving a standard transmission car, you have your accelerator. Right? Your gas, like in any automobile. And you have your brake. But what else do you have? You have a clutch. Right? And in order to drive this car well, you really want to accelerate it. You're always going to have to pay attention to the possibility that if you slow the car down, you need to be ready to apply the clutch. Because what happens if you don't use the clutch? Right. Thank you. That was right. That's well said. It's not just, it doesn't just stall. Right? It stalls traumatically. My older brother taught me to drive a stick shift. Speaking of traumatic, right? Because I'm that guy who's sitting in the intersection watching the light go from green to yellow to red four times, while I'm in the intersection trying to get. Oh no! I guess you have to be in first gear before you go. Right? If we don't have a clutch, we have traumatic cessation of the engine. Fair enough. Okay. So imagine this. A baby is born, and a baby come. We like to say, all babies come into the world looking for someone looking for him, looking for someone looking for her, and it never stops, right? You're a newborn, and you're looking for someone looking for you, and when you are in the boardroom, you are looking for someone looking for you. When you come to church for the first time, you're looking for someone looking for you, right? We love this notion that when we come into any space, there's somebody there who says, I am so glad to see you. I have no idea who you are, but I'm glad to see you. Right? Who doesn't love that? We love this notion. And Shore would say that the mission of a newborn for the first 18 months of life is the establishment of joyfully connected human relationships. The mission of a baby is to be in the room and whoever they encounter looks at the baby and says, oh my gosh, you're so cute. If somebody were to bring a newborn in right now, I'm over. I'm so done. Because you would start paying attention to the newborn. I'm useless. Right? And this is the thing. It never stops for us. We always are looking for someone who would be willing to come find us when we most need to be found. And in fact, I want you to be willing to find the parts of me that I'm worried that when you see them, you will want to leave. Are you with me? Shore would say, this is what we do. We are born into the world, created, made for joy. We live this way because there is a particular part of our brain called the sympathetic drive system. that is constantly running, curious, energetic, seeking out, wanting to find things. It's just go, go. It's the gas of our car. But the problem is that if we continue with just an accelerator, at some point the car is going to have trouble, right? Because you just can't just keep going, because at some point, like, you run people over or you run into things. At some point, we have to be able to apply the brake. Would that be fair to say? And right, at some point, the child is going to be like running for the begonias. And we're going to want to, like, we're going to have to stop the child. And so we're going to have to do what? Say what? Stop. Or no. Like, we have to say no. Right? We have to apply the brake. Exactly. And the brake, as far as the child's brain is concerned, is the activation of the parasympathetic system in that child's brain. For human beings, the sympathetic system is what is in sympathy with what we want to do, what we're curious about, where we want to go. And the sympathetic system is all about slowing that process down, applying the brake. And we can do that one of two ways. You can slow down a car either by applying the brake or by just simply taking your foot off the gas. The question is not whether or not we need to say no to things. In fact, we would say that if you look at the Garden of Eden, like, I'm wondering, in the middle of the garden, God plants this tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and he says no, right? Is that right? Do you know about that story in the Bible? Right? Okay, so it's a story in the Bible, and it says no. Now, if I'm God, and I really don't want people eating from this tree, I'm planting the tree like 1,000 miles to the west, because like they don't even have wheels yet, so they can't even walk that far, right? And you'd say, if you ever come upon the tree 1,000 miles to the west, just ignore it. I've got a bunch of like thorn bushes. Like, don't. No. Where does he plant it? He plants it right in the center of the garden. You see, this is what's important for us to know. God's no is as significant a part of his love as is his yes. In fact, it is central to his love. And we in the West, like, we don't live as if, like, anybody who says no, like, that's not a loving thing to do, right? To say no, like, no, here are some guardrails. Here's some behavior. Here are some ethics where we say no to things. And we don't like that, because I want to do whatever I please. I don't want anybody telling me no. But we recognize that if we're not willing to actually say no, we run into all kinds of problems. Think of this. How many of you today, in the course of today, you had some experience in which you could have said something that you chose not to, and you're glad you didn't? Do you ever have that? You have that experience today? Like, yeah, you think it, don't say it. Right? Think of the number of things that we could do or that we could say that we choose not to, because in fact, there is a great deal of the activity of the brain that is committed to the action of restraint, to the act of saying no. Part of the hard thing is, some of the places where I most want to say yes are central to my deepest longings, but to which life or God or something says no, like death. Are you with me? No is never easy, but it is, in the developing child, necessary. Are you with me? Here's the thing. It's not that no is necessary. That's true. The question is always, how do we say it? The question is always, how do we apply the brake? The question is, how do we actually decelerate the car? And the way that we do it most effectively is by making sure we have a clutch. You see, the death that you've experienced in this community is the experience of no with no clutch. Are you with me? There's no warning. There's no clutch. There's no kindness. There's no long, slow glide path landing this plane. It just happens, and it's not right. And evil depends upon it. Because one of the things that we experience neurobiologically when we have the experience of no with no clutch in place is the very thing that we call shame. The felt sense of this is what happens when the engine is suddenly slowed or even over a long time slowed, but no clutch is applied. And what is the clutch? The clutch is always going to be understood in terms of a deeply connected interpersonal human interaction. So when I'm saying to my toddler, no, the question is not, do I say no? The question is, how do I say this? You know, I'm the kind of guy who, like, I love to rule my house by fiat, right? You speak it and it is done. All right, Caesar, right? This sense, like, you just like to say to your kids, do this and it is done. It never happened to me. It never worked this way. Our kids are 26 and 23, and it didn't happen this way. You'd like to be able to say, like, the kid is on the other side of the room, and it's time to go. And they're like 2.5, and you say, like, it's time to go. And you think, it's time to go. Like, the four most powerful words, I've just uttered them, and they come, right? They just drop. No! It's like they don't know who you are. They're not talking to you, right? They're not. And so you have to, like, I don't want to have to do the extra work of saying, either you can come to me or I can come get you. I don't want to do the extra work. I'm a lazy parent. A psychiatrist, I write books, but I'm a lazy parent. And so I just would like to just do this and be done. To say no to them requires that I am actually being deeply attuned to where they are, such that I'm going to have to go the extra mile to say no in a way that keeps us deeply connected in the process. Does that make sense? That means that we then can say no to anything and everything to which no needs to be said, as long as it is said in the context of deeply attuned communication. But, like, okay, what about this? So I grew up in a family. I'm the youngest. Now, there are two ways that you can tell my story. Well, I'm sure you can tell my story multiple different ways, but two ways you can tell my story. I'm the youngest of four sons. So my parents, as I said, my parents were 45 when I was born, and my brothers were 18, 16, and 11 when I was born, right? My mom's 44, my dad's 45 when I was born. And in 1962, if you're 44 and pregnant, people are wondering what you were doing. I mean, like, they know what you were doing, but they're like, what were you thinking while you were, well, we weren't thinking, we were just doing what we were doing, right? And then now there's Kurt, right? But if you're 44 in 1962 and you're pregnant, you're worried. And so I was born into a family where, as it turned out, you know, and some would say, yeah, and they're still worried, right? I'm 54 and people are still worried about what this looks like. But the thing is, like, you're born into a family where people are already anxious. And then you're born and they're not sure, like, well, what is that? Like, what's he going to be like? You know, well, he's breathing. And he's got four limbs, you know, but, like, what will it mean when he's, like, 6 months of age? Like, you were still wondering about, like, where this is going to go, because we just don't know. But my brothers, right, my oldest brother, like, he went off to college and I was born the next week. Right? So, this is not a bad thing, in essence, but I grew up in a house where by the time I'm 7 years old, my brothers are all gone, right? They're out of the house. Now, I grew up in a family where my father grew up on a farm in Ohio. And he was a lover of animals, but he believed that all animals needed to be living either outside or in a barn. Animals were not made to live in houses, right? So we were never allowed, we weren't allowed to have pets that would be in the house, okay? And this was a well-known fact. We all kind of knew about this. And because my brothers had talked about that, and I'd hear, you hear the family, and even as a seven-year-old, you kind of like, no, like, well, you're not ever going to, we don't have dogs. And we didn't, like, no, 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 no. And like, so I live, like, okay, we don't have pets. Christmas, when I'm seven, my brothers decide they want to get a dog for me for Christmas, right? Convenient. They're not at home, right? They're all out of the house, right? Now, here's the thing. I don't have an explicit memory of this story. Most of how I remember this story is because of my hearing my brothers tell it. As I grew older, even as an adult, I heard it told dozens and dozens and dozens of times, but somebody else is telling the story. And the story went like this. My brothers would say, well, we were going to get Kurt the dog, and we talked to Mom, and we said, we would like to get Kurt the dog, and Mom said, you get the dog, I'll take care of your dad. I don't know what that meant either, okay? But like, I'll take care of your dad. You just get the dog. Now, again, I don't remember, but here's what I know. There was an 8mm tape. Anybody know what 8mm film was? Long time ago, right? That shows me on Christmas morning. And I run into the viewfinder of the camera, and there's a big red box. I don't know what it is. I have no idea. I lift up the box. Out jumps this puppy. And I am out of my mind with delirium. I'm jumping up. I don't even know where the puppy is. Like, I'm jumping up and down. I'm like crazy with excitement because, like, we know, like, this doesn't happen, right? It's like Jesus has returned, right? This is, I mean, it's that phenomenal of a moment, right? In the house. And by 3 o'clock that afternoon, the dog was gone. Now, here's the thing. I told that story in November at a staff retreat of my private practice. And I have told that story dozens of times in the course of my lifetime. And I'm usually telling the story from the perspective that my brothers have always historically told it, which, of course, they like to talk about it because they kind of got the shaft, right? Because they bought the dog, but they didn't have to. Then they had to, like, find an owner for the dog because they weren't allowed to. I wasn't allowed to keep the dog. And I just kind of think, like, it's a funny thing. And when I told this story to my staff had much the same reaction that you just had, only they were actually even more, like a little militant about how, like, wrong this was. And, like, they're therapists, right? And I look at them and I said, like, why are you so, like, upset? Like, it's a dog. I say this to them. And they say, no, Kurt, it's a 7-year-old boy. And I say to them, who hired you? Because it's the first time, like, I'm 54 years old. It's the first time in my life that anyone has ever confronted me about the way I tell this story. Because the way I tell the story is like, it's just no big deal. And when you have like a collection of therapists who are just like, you know, en masse, like running at you like a rugby team, you can't get away from the reality that there's something shearing about this story. There's something that is not right. And in the course of the last 6 to 8 months, quite literally, which have been 6 to 8 of the most difficult months I've had in 30 years, this story has played no small role, because one of the things that I've discovered is that even though I grew up in a house where I had two Jesus-loving parents, a father who's deeply affectionate, deeply committed, loving, kind, and so forth, a mother the same. The reality was, it turns out I spent a lot of my life learning how to make sure that I didn't piss off my dad and didn't make my mom anxious. But you don't know that you're learning to do this when you're learning to do this. It's just life. So, for instance, I have the recollection that nobody ever talked with me about this whole thing. Like, nobody ever came to me and said, I have no memory of anybody coming to me and said, like, just by the way, you can't keep the dog. Like, no memory. Like, the dog was just gone. Like, I kind of heard about it, you know, I don't know, through the grapevine, through my brothers, through somebody, we can't keep the dog. And I do remember having the felt sense, like, I'm going to have to be okay with this. Like, as a 7-year-old, I'm going to have to be okay with this. Now, most people would look at this and say, like, look, this is not, you know, this is not Afghanistan. This is not sexual abuse. This is not something awful. It's a dog. And we would say, no, actually, this is shame. Because this is what happens when you get any kid. And here's the thing, like, all of us in the room, like, well-educated, we're smart. We look at our lives, and our lives don't look like they're that awful. And why is it? Well, because probably for many of us, like, we've been working really, really hard to make sure that nobody else in the room thinks that our life is that awful. We've been working really hard to make sure that we cover up all those places where shame is in the nooks and crannies, taking up lots of your mental energy with your just trying to cover it, and leaving you with that much less energy in which God wants to use you to make the next new thing. Does that make sense? And so it begins early and often in the confines of our stories in our families, long before we're even aware that it's on the loose. And we are constantly in the business of trying to find ways to cope with it. And we don't even know that that's what we're doing. But by the time we get to age 54, we've practiced this story. We know that this story is not that big of a deal. We know it's just a dog, and it's just a story, and it's all pretty funny. We don't, like, I don't really know that, like, my brother's telling of it is really a way for my brothers to kind of, like, also cope with the fact that everybody was afraid to say that my dad could be angry in a way that we couldn't tolerate. Like, we didn't grow up in a family where we would just say, like, you know, he doesn't have an anger problem, and the reason he doesn't is because we make sure that he never gets angry. Does that make sense? That's all what happens when shame is shearing off literally your brain's anticipated desire to do the next thing it wants to do. Naked and ashamed is what it becomes. So when you learn, so like this, like if you're the 10-year-old boy and you come to your dad or your mom with the test of 92% because you're working really hard and you've done really well, and they say to you, this is great, where's the other 8%? I'm sure nobody in this room has ever had this happen, right? So here's the thing, right? We would say, what happens literally in that person's brain is that the neural networks that are responsible for and activated by the sympathetic drive system that is coming to create and to share and to put on display the thing that I've done well is now literally spliced together with the neural networks in which the parasympathetic system is slamming, shearing this off, no warning, no attuned communication, in which dad says, where's the other 8%? And so by the time I'm 18, I'm working really hard to make sure I have 100% because I can't afford to make mistakes, because in the day that I do, I'm going to experience this neurobiological feature of what I felt like when I was 10, only I just think I'm working really hard. That's the way I tell the story. Does that make sense? And when that process happens, in which no is uttered in some way, verbal or non, with no clutch applied, no attuned communication. Like, look, it would be it is possible that, like, it wasn't a good idea for me to have the dog. Like, that's a possibility, right? I've got two parents who are now in their 50s who don't, like, they're going to take care of the dog. We all know this. Low 7-year-old. They're not going to turn this over to a 7-year-old. I've got three adult brothers who aren't living at home. My parents might not want to have a dog, and that might be a reasonable thing. The reasonable thing then to do would be, like, the parent comes to the 7-year-old and says, like, we need to have a talk. And we might have to have a talk that's going to last for the next few days. Because I know that this isn't going to feel very good, but we can't keep the dog. And if somebody is willing to, like, stay with that person, even in the process of saying no, shame doesn't happen. Because what we are experiencing, sensing, feeling, imaging as the 7-year-old is being deeply attuned to. So that even someone has the ability to say no in a way that might even be reasonable, but they're saying no in a way in which shame does not get to be part of the conversation. Which means, interestingly enough, I can then learn that, gosh, you can have the experience of, like, having restraint, of delaying gratification. You can learn that you can say no to things and it not be a shaming experience. Instead of, like, thinking, like, gosh, every time I have to say no, it's just like I'm losing one more thing. Because my brain is left by itself to figure out what it's going to do with the outcome of this felt sense of disorientation that comes without anybody coming to my rescue. And here's the thing. It keeps happening until we're dead. Right? You might not be the 7-year-old who's just lost a puppy. You might be the board member who's just been, like, you've just had your latest offering idea deflected. You might be the pastor who wants to initiate something and you've got a board of elders that are just, they're just not so crazy about that. You might be the one who wants to have the conversation. Anybody been to, like, a conversation, right? You're at a cocktail party. You're in a conversation with three other people, and people are talking about, you know, nothing, because nothing gets talked about at cocktail parties, right? And we're there, we're talking about, but even your particular nothing that you're offering gets ignored. Anybody ever have that experience? Like, and, like, how does that feel? You like that? Right? No, nobody like, I want to go to the party so I can be ignored. Nobody does this. If they do, they're coming to see me on Monday, right? But even in those situations, when we offer something and it's ignored. That's shame. That's a deceleration with no acknowledgement that you even said anything. And it happens in multiple domains of our vocational calling all day, every day. And here's the thing. Like, we experience shame in large ways, right? If you're a female in the West, why don't you, in the East, in the Middle East, like it probably, it may be even worse, right? If you're a female, you have a 1 in 3 to 1 in 5 chance of having been sexually assaulted by the time you're 25. Men, look around the room. Do the math. The statistics are not good. And even as awful as that is not the way that shame presents itself most often. Because most of where shame operates is in the confines of the privacy of our own minds. Like, you wake up this morning and you hit the snooze button 4 times. And by the second time, your own private shame attendant is already complaining to you about how late you're going to be. And then you finally get up and you get to the bathroom where they have things called mirrors. Right? And you're like, oh my gosh, another 5 pounds. And then you, and then it just starts. And it's from there, like all day, every day. And imagine the number, like, should have done this. I should have done that. And you don't, after a while, like, you're not even using words. Because most of how shame is operational doesn't have anything to do with language. Because our brains are most sensitive, most Velcro-y, we remember things most powerfully that we sense, image, and feel far more than words that we hear. So, if you're looking then at Genesis chapter 3, if you're looking at Genesis chapter 3, you see this story, right, in which the woman and the snake are having a conversation. And shame shows up, right? She eats the fruit. Things go downhill from there. And what I want to invite us to consider is that shame actually shows up in this conversation long before any fruit gets eaten. And that the eating of the fruit, the picking and the eating of the fruit, is a way for the woman to cope with shame that's already happening in the context of what the evil one is doing in the context of the conversation. I had a patient who, when she was 19, I learned this when she was in her 50s, when she was 19 years of age, her father came to her. Her father, who was in whose eyes she was the apple, right? Her father, who she loved dearly, lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And he comes to her at age 19 and says to her, "Honey, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving your mother and I'm moving to Seattle, where I have another family." This is weird. I have another family? Yes. I have another person who I'm going to marry, and I have another child, and that's where I'm going to go. Now, can you imagine being 19 and, like, you think that this, like, this is your life, and this life is great? And of course, he adds that, I just want you to know the reason I'm telling you is because it's not your fault. I will guarantee you, there is no way that that 19-year-old will not, and she did not, have it any other way but that it was her fault. Because if my dad can choose to go something like, nobody's holding a gun to your head. Imagine if you're Eve and you're having a conversation with the snake in which you think you live in a world in which your father loves you unconditionally. Your father loves you, wants the best for you. And then you have someone who comes along and says, just so you know, your father doesn't really want you playing with his toys. Your father doesn't want you becoming like him at all. How fun would that be to hear? This father that you thought was so wonderful, in whose eye you thought you were the apple. You see, the snake tells her something about God. God does not want you to eat of the fruit. But then allows her to hear him say something to her about herself. It's the same thing that the snake in devil form said to Jesus in the desert after his baptism. If you really were God's son, you would do X, Y, and Z. God wouldn't make you out be out here in the desert and not have food. That's ridiculous. What father would do that? God wouldn't give you these gifts and then have you not use your charisma. God wouldn't give you these leadership skills and then not have you, you know, use them to the maximum. What God would do that? In the same thing he says to the woman, what God would give you all this and then say no? You see, he's not just telling her something about God. You follow me? And this is what happens to my 19-year-old patient. And this is what happens to a kid who's 7 years of age who doesn't know that he doesn't know this. He's being told, like, what you really want doesn't matter. Nobody's saying this to me directly. They don't have to. I've already figured this out, and this is the story that I tell. What are we to do in 5 minutes? Okay. We're going to walk through something really quickly, and then we'll have questions. Let me just say, one thing I tell people, the news about shame is far worse than you know, and far better than you can imagine. And here's why. When you read in the 12th chapter of the book of Hebrews, we read this: therefore, since we have before us such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily distracts and entangles us, and run the race set before us with perseverance, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. Let me just say, we can walk through this quickly. I wrote a book about this, stuff. So you go buy the book. Buy many, many copies of the book. I was at a place earlier this afternoon. I said, like, I would love to see an Amazon spike, like in the next 48 hours, right, of the book, right? And we walk through this in detail. I'm just going to walk through it real briefly. But here's the question, right? This is not like an academic exercise, right? This is like, what's God doing in the room right now? And what's God going to do in our lives, in our community, even in a community that has been so traumatized in the last fortnight? Therefore, since we have before us such a great cloud of witnesses, here's the first question. Shame works effectively because it works in isolation. It isolates our brain within itself, and it isolates us from other people. Who makes up your great cloud of witnesses? Who are the three people, the five people that you could name for me, whom if I were to ask them, they could tell me everything there is to know about you? Everything. They don't just know your vital statistics. They know the last time you looked at pornography. They know the last time that you gossiped. They know your deepest fear. They know your greatest longing. They know the thing that you're most proud of. They know all the moments when you didn't get to keep the dog. Here's the news. When we are deeply known by this deep cloud of witnesses, it prevents shame from having corners in which to hide. Neurobiologically, it changes our brains because those very neural networks that represent our experiences of shame are actively being changed when we tell our stories, including the things that we feel that are shaming, to people who, when they're listening, are giving us a very different response. You see, I had always told my story about the dog in a certain way, and when my therapist confronted me about this, like, it changed everything about, like, I couldn't tell that story the same way any longer, because now I've got this, you know, this, like, cavalry of therapists who are saying, like, no, this is not the way this story is. And I've got the memory of faces and voices and body language speaking to me, because these are people who care about my welfare. Who are the people who are in our life, who make up the great cloud of witnesses, who are bearing witness to our lives? It must be done this way. We live in a world that wants desperately for us to live out as individuals. We think we should be able to survive as individuals, do fine, that we should be great on our own, by our own. The brain is not made to live this way. It cannot live this way. It cannot survive. It certainly can't thrive this way. Who makes up your great cloud of witnesses? Therefore, since we have this great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off the sin that so easily entangles and distracts. One translation says the sin that so easily distracts. All sin begins with distraction. We live in a world, and I'm not a Luddite, but we live in a world whose technology is intending. It depends upon your not paying attention. It depends upon your being easily distracted. We no longer read literature long and deeply. We can't do it because our brains are no longer able to do it, because of how much time we spend on the internet being distracted by all the pop-up ads. We are being distracted all the time, and then we practice being more easily distracted by all the stuff that's banging around in our head, including all that stuff that our shame attendant wants to be yapping at us, including the story that says, it's just a dog. Okay? We have to throw that off. It must be restrained. It must be disciplined. It's hard work. I will say, though, if we go to the beginning, which is like the great cloud of witnesses, the brain is willing to do lots of things that are hard to do. It's just much more difficult for it to do it on its own. It loves doing hard work for long periods of time if it's doing it with somebody else. It can do this. Right? Because we were, let us make mankind in our image to live like we live. Throw off the sin that so easily distracts us and run with perseverance the race that is set before us. We have this word in neuroscience called neuroplasticity. Maybe some of you have heard of it. All right, it's about the capacity of the brain to change over time. And here's one of the key elements. One of the key elements is practice. And in the biblical narrative's language, that would be the word perseverance. It's the word practicing, 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 practicing in the context of community. Right? When we make mistakes, what we need to hear is not like, gosh, what a screw up you are. No, what we need to hear is, this is really hard to do. Let's do this again. This is really hard to do. Let's do this again. Grieving is really hard to do. It may take this community a year just to get through the first phase of the grief of the loss of this man. Here's the thing. Jesus is not worried about this. He's not worried because he's too busy working on your behalf. It will take perseverance. It will not take worrying. Worrying is not going to help us. Perseverance will help us. It will require practicing, remaining in the present moment, continually coming back to those of us who know this man well and saying, like, gosh, today is just really hard. And have somebody say, like, you're damn right it is. Let's do this again. Let's keep going. This is really hard to do. Run the race with perseverance, fixing our eyes on Jesus. Now, here's where we really don't have enough time. Here's the first question. When you imagine this phrase, fixing our eyes on Jesus, do we imagine fixing our eyes on the Jesus whose eyes are already fixed on us? Is that just a figment of our imagination? Is that just an abstract thing that some shrink is talking about on some random Wednesday night? Or is this the thing that tomorrow morning and this evening before I go to bed, I'm going to practice imagining what does it look like seeing the face of a 33-year-old Jew in blue jeans and a t-shirt looking at me with kindness, with intensity, with confidence? If I'm not practicing paying attention to that, I'm not changing my brain and the words mean nothing. We don't just fix our eyes on him having fixed his eyes on us. We also watch what he does and then do what he does. And one of the things that he does is he acts in response to having heard his father say, you're my son whom I love and in whom I'm well pleased. This is another question. How many of us this morning woke up with the voice of our dad in our mind saying, gosh, I'm so glad that today is here. I can't wait to live today with you. I can't wait. Can you imagine waking up in your bedroom and there's the Holy Trinity sitting, all three of them. You're like, excuse me. And they're like, God, we just couldn't wait. Like, we've been waiting all night for you, frankly, right? It's time to get up because, like, we want to live with you today. Let's go. How many of us are living in a world in which this is actually true, or how many of us, for us, it's just some fairy tale? If we take the biblical narrative seriously, this is the world in which we live. And here's the thing. If we don't see the Trinity in our bedroom, then who will be our great cloud of witnesses who will demonstrate that for us? Who will be the people who will remind us that what Jesus saw and heard was for real? We see what Jesus did and we do what he did. And that's a whole other question about what happens in John 21 when Jesus reinstates Peter after his great debacle. Do you love me? And it gets to the third time and Peter was grieved in his heart that Jesus asked me it a third time. I'm just going to offer this to you. My guess is that it's possible. I would wonder, is it possible that Peter was grieved mostly because he's thinking to himself, okay, finally, like, okay, it's true. Like, no, I don't. Because if I really did love you, I wouldn't have thrown you under the bus 6 weeks ago. Right? Are you happy now? Now that you've like put this out in front of God and everybody else, all the disciples, like I'm grieved because what you're doing is putting your finger on old residual stuff from my story that I am really still worried about. You want me to lead, you want me to feed sheep, but like with this still hanging over my head, no thank you. This is why I'm going to go back to fishing, which is what I was doing when you were fixing breakfast on the beach. And Jesus says to him over and over, no, I have work for you. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep coming for every shard of shame that exists in your heart until we have it exposed on a platter in front of everybody else. Oh, thank you very much. In front of everybody else, in order for me to say, this is not who you are. I am who you are, and I have work for you to do. But this is something that we must experience in embodied and blooded places in this cloud of witnesses. It can't be done in the figments of our imagination. Evil is counting on it happening by ourselves, alone in some room, because he knows that when he gets you by yourself, like, he runs the story. He tells the story. Two last things. Jesus, who endured the cross, scorning its shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. Two last things, and then we'll go to Q&A. The first thing is scorning its shame. So you would, if you were to go to a party, and you were to, and your worst enemy were at the party, you would not be accused, probably, of scorning your enemy if you went into the room, didn't know your enemy was there, and you left the party. You wouldn't be accused of scorning them because you didn't know they were there. The reason you would be accused of scorning them would be if you went in, you found them, you saw them, you said, I hate you, and you leave. Right? How we scorn things. We identify them and turn away from them. Shame very much, when we have this experience, it very much wants us to not pay attention to it. And it's kind of what we do, right? We feel shame and then we turn away and we feel ashamed for feeling ashamed and we don't want to look at it. Does that make sense? Jesus does the very opposite. You know, if you were to Google images for a crucifix, there would be one thing that you would see out of the 200 images that you would see on the first page. You might see two images that are completely accurate. And how would they be accurate? Jesus on the cross, right? How else would they be accurate? Two out of 200 images of a crucifix. What would you notice that would make them completely accurate, that are unlike the other 98%? What? What's that? He's completely naked. The Romans didn't just kill people, they humiliated people. And people were not on crosses 20 feet away, 8 feet in the road, 8 feet in the air. No, they were 2 feet off the road and they were 6 inches off the ground. Like, you're passing by people with all their stuff hanging out. Even in our artwork, we have a hard time allowing for Jesus to come as deeply into our shame as he has come. Let me be very clear. This is not an advocation for us to go around and strip all the crucifixes of his loincloth. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, like, we have a hard time allowing God to be in these nooks and crannies where he wants to come, where Jesus comes with Peter in John 21, because he is scorning it. He is coming to find it. So here's an exercise that you can do. You get a 3x5 card. You might want to buy a stack. You start tomorrow morning, and every time you sense, image, feel, think, or act in any way that you think is about shame, you put a mark on the card. I don't want to know why you're doing it. I don't need to know the origin of it. I don't need to know what it's all about. I just need you to make a mark on the card. And here's what happens. If you make a mark on the card, you do one neurobiological thing that's crucially important. For most of us, when we are in the middle of something that is shaming of us, we don't even know it until 3 days later. Right? It's minutes, hours, days that we've been down in the rabbit hole before it even occurs to us that we're in the middle of this. The moment I sense it and simply make a mark on the card, I literally interrupt the neural network pathway that has me living automatically down the rabbit hole. And the more I am able to stop that process, the more I am able to then practice turning my attention back to something else. And what's the something else? You're my daughter. You're my son, whom I love and whom I'm well pleased. But again, I can't just turn my attention to words on a page. I have to be turning my attention to names and faces of people who were in my cloud of witnesses, who are bearing witness to my life, drawing my attention away from shame and back to the vocational calling that God has for me in that moment. And I will say that in this community, one of your now new vocational callings is that of properly grieving the loss of one of your own. We don't like this. God doesn't like this. But he is unafraid of it. And he's coming to find you. And the way he's going to find you is in those places where you find each other and the body of Jesus becomes the house and the temple of the Holy Spirit. And sadness and grief are stated in the presence of a God who says, even in this space, I will not leave you alone. And in the end, I'm coming to find you all, and a new heaven and a new earth is going to be the rule. But until then, we are practicing for what's coming, as hard as it may be. And then the last thing, what does it mean? And it says, and then he sat down at the right hand of God. In the letter to the church at Colossae, Paul writes this, for you have died, in the third chapter, the third verse, for you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. We can read that till the cows come home. And it will mean nothing if I do not have a way to practice, literally, to practice imagining and in embodied ways believing that my life is literally with Christ and I'm hidden in God. This can't just be some theological fact that I've collected and like archived in my left hemisphere. This must be a living, breathing, imagined experience of the day that when I step off the porch step, that I am deeply aware that I am with Jesus. Like I am imagining a 33-year-old Jew walking with me down my street. This takes practice and it takes community to do this. And then to imagine, like if I'm with Christ and I'm hidden with, and I'm with Christ, hidden in God, what does that, we're like, where does it mean that you are? If Christ is at God's right hand, what does it mean? For us to be turning and they're like, there's our dad. And our dad says like, it's so great to have you at my right hand. Because if we're with Christ in God and he's at God's right hand, this is where we are. But this takes great work on our imagination's part. This is something that neuroscience in and of itself will never tell you. But it's something that living in the body of Jesus will, practicing it as we will in our clouds of witnesses until that great day of the appearance of our Master. And I think I'm going to stop with that. I've been yapping a long time. You've been a lovely audience. I think we'll just take some time for some questions, if that's okay.
So, if I get this right, because I did last night too, shame will stay with us to the day we die, but we can reduce it and work with it by acknowledging it, speaking about it, and making eye contact with other people, and that's good.
So that's the question, right? So the question is, do we get rid of shame? So here's part of the challenge, right? And the challenge is we remember stuff. And the things that have happened to us earlier in our life, we remember more effectively. And we don't want to. Like, we wish that we could not, right? We wish we could forget. And so there is this rather strange thing of neuroplasticity and how, like, the more we've practiced things, the more permanent it becomes. And so even when we learn to tell stories in different ways, new ways. I'm guessing John 21, when Jesus reinstates Peter, I'm guessing that's not the last time Peter has trouble with this part of his mind that is worried about what he's done to Jesus. But I am guessing that because other people are on the beach, we can all come around Peter and it's like, no, dude, like he said, like, we're cool. We're good. We're really good. And Peter's like, man, I screwed this up again. No, listen. Like, we have to pay attention to this. So we do learn to practice telling a different narrative. And the notion of articulating and regulating, identifying shame earlier in the process, which means we can turn our attention to a new story sooner in the process, which means we don't allow shame to have as much time in our attention gathering processes. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. Hope that's helpful. And so anything that we do, right, anything that we do in embodied ways that brings joy, that brings creativity, right? So here's a question. What things are there that God wants you to create that you won't create because there's too much shame? If shame is not part of the conversation, what is it that you're going to make? What is it that you're going to have? What conversation are you going to have? What rupture needs to be repaired, but shame is like still lurking at the door? What new endeavor do you wish you could take, but like you don't even think to take it because like you've just like been listening to shame talk to you for 50 years? Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Yes, in the back. Right. So, right, yeah. So practical ideas about how we create clouds of witnesses. So the first thing I would say is like, you know, we like to say in medicine that people are more likely to take medication when they are adequately forewarned about side effects ahead of the game, right? If you don't warn them about side effects, when the side effects come, they're quickly going to jettison taking the drug or the intervention. So here's something to consider. The first thing is generating and creating clouds of witnesses is really hard to do. That's the first word. So there's this lovely book called Genesis, The Story We Haven't Heard, written by a guy named Paul Borgman. And Borgman is a professor of literature at a place called Gordon University outside Boston. It's a Christian college. And he's a literature professor, and he teaches the book of Genesis as a literature course every year. And one of the main characters that he addresses is the character of Abraham. And Paul asked this question that I think is really helpful. He's like, how many people did God try to convince to go to Palestine before he finally got Abraham to agree to him? We don't know because there's no story there. And you ask a similar question. How many people did Jesus ask to follow him before Andrew and Peter and James and John agreed? We don't know. We know people left the ministry afterwards. Who knows how hard it was because we don't have their stories? I want to suggest that it's important to know that Jesus knows that this is hard to do, first of all, right? Number one. Number two, and this is where the side effect comes in. You've been here in this conversation, and you start by thinking of two people, maybe even one person, that is in your life that you trust enough to say, hey, I wish that we could come together and start to like have some conversation that's deeper than what we usually do. And they're like, well, sure, what does that mean? And it may, and then it begins to, you know, we then start to like tell stories together. I'm going to tell you my story, and you tell me your story, and we might even have a third party. To have at least three people in a cohort is a helpful place to begin. Recognizing that at any point in time, it's possible that somebody's going to cross a threshold in which they can't tolerate the intimacy, and they're going to go. Leslie Newbegin says a powerful thing in his commentary on the Gospel of John, The Light Has Come. He gets to the end of chapter 10 of John's Gospel, in which we've moved from chapter 6 to chapter 10, feeding of 5,000, at which point they wanted to make him king by force. And we get to chapter 10 at the end, and Jesus is saying to his disciples, do you too want to leave me? Because they are the only ones left. And Newbegin says this. He says, and with this we see that the preaching of the gospel leads not, as it turns out, to church growth, but rather to its opposite. So it's important to know that the very act of beginning the process of telling our stories with one another is potentially fraught with a side effect that people are going to become uncomfortable with this. But for those who don't, practically speaking, you can begin by the following. Number one, if you haven't done this, you write your autobiography. You can write your, you handwrite your autobiography. You take an hour, you write about the first 10 years. These things are mapped out in the first book and then in the second book as well that you're all going to buy. Right, so you can write your autobiography, and then, and by that we say, like, I just want you to write about the first 10 years of your life. Take an hour, write about the first. We don't want War and Peace. We're looking for things that you're paying attention to that have to do with things that you feel, things that you sense, the relational interactions, those kinds of things. And then you leave it away. You leave it for a week and come back and you take an hour and you write about your second decade and then your third decade and so forth. And then you're going to read this to someone. And the first time you all gather, one person of the three of you is going to read your autobiography, and then you're going to give people the option of asking questions. Who? What? Where? When? How? And this is hard to do. Like, we're practicing for heaven, because it's important to know, when Jesus has no problem asking us these questions. It is in the asking of these questions that, in fact, more of our story is told. More accurately. Like my therapist's asking me these questions. And then the next notion is this whole notion of scorning shame. Explicitly identifying things that we are feeling shame attached to and being able to name these things. Now, by this, we don't mean look, I've got a list of 317 things, and that's just from today, okay? No, we're talking about learning to practice this by saying, today I'm going to name one thing. And I'm going to name one thing that I'm ashamed of. It might not even be the worst thing, but I'm going to name one thing because I'm testing the waters of what it's like for me to be seen by a cloud of witnesses. And the next week I might have to name one thing that feels just a little higher on the amplitude mark of how bad this shame feels. And so forth and so on. And here's what I think you're going to find. If it becomes a regular practice that we have a group of people with whom it is routine for us to be sharing this kind of confessional life, here's what happens to the brain. You see, we like to say that the brain is one big anticipation machine. That's one way to describe it, which means I'm already, even the stuff that I've not done yet, that I'm going to be ashamed of, I'm already worried about them. Because I'm worried that I don't have a cloud of witnesses that can really help me manage that, that can help me take care of this when it happens. But with this kind of practice, I will tell you that within 6 weeks of doing this on a regular basis, it will change how you anticipate your future. Because if I am not worrying any longer about the things that I might do for which I will be ashamed, I will be less likely to commit the acts in the first place. Because so much of the things that I do that are shameful are emergent out of the anxiety that is based in shame to begin with. Does that make sense? I hope those are helpful in small ways. Yes. So the question is, what's the connection between what happens in the office?
Well, I'm really interested in your view as a clinician of the connection between mental illness and the shame that you've been talking about.
Right. So what's the connection between mental illness and the dynamism of the shame and its works and how it operates that we've been talking about tonight? Okay. So let me just say this much. First of all, what mental illness is and mental health is, of course, is up for grabs, right? Who knows who in this, how many of us are mentally ill in the room, right? Maybe more of us than are actually here, because some of us might be multiple personality, and you just never know. There's more of us, right? All right, okay, all right. So the point being, they're like, the phrase mental illness, as my daughter, the seminarian would say, look, Dad, words don't really have definitions. They have usage. We use words in certain ways. So it would depend upon what we mean by the use of that phrase mentally ill. If we're talking about someone who, for instance, has schizophrenia, right? Or someone who has a fairly severe form, let's say, of manic depressive illness, right? These are categories of emotional experiences that we might say that's mental illness. But somebody who's severely depressed, we wouldn't call that mental illness. Well, at what point does one cross from one into the other, right? So this is what I would say, that, and we don't have time, we've not had time to go into all this. In the field of interpersonal neurobiology, we talk about the notion of integration and disintegration. And these are words that emerge out of the world of physics, actually, that apply to the brain and relationships and that make up the notion of what we mean by the mind, which we didn't talk about tonight in described detail. But we would say that there are multiple different ways in which people can experience disintegration. You can experience that if you have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. You can experience that if you have malignant grief. Right? What's the difference between somebody who has schizophrenia but gets to work every day and somebody who can't get out of bed for 6 months because of grief? Who's more mentally ill? Right? So part of our challenge is that what I'm going to suggest is that one of the things that shame does is that it is constantly operating not just in the lives of the people who are afflicted. If anybody here has any experience with anybody with schizophrenia, for instance, one of the things that you will recognize pretty quickly is that someone with schizophrenia often doesn't really think they have a problem. Right? For a person who has schizophrenia, if that person is in a community, who has the problem? Right, the community has the problem, right? And part of our problem is because we don't think the person thinks that they have a problem. But now we have a problem with them not having a problem. And we are the ones who are far more distressed that they're not taking their medicine than that they are taking their medicine. You see where this goes. I talk about this in a portion of the book, although I don't talk about schizophrenia in explicitly, but John 9, the Gospel of John, the chapter John 9, is what happens when shame becomes systematized. For many people who are mentally ill, the problem is less also often about the person who has the illness, who might not think that they do, than it is for the people who are living with them, who have a big problem with them thinking they don't have a problem. And in this case, we are the ones who feel powerless. We are the ones who feel like we don't have what it takes. We are the ones who feel bad that this person is not in great shape, but there's nothing we can do to stop this. All that to say is that to the degree that people are consciously able to be aware of the things that we're talking about, we can work with that in any number of ways. And people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder have elements in which they're aware of things that they are ashamed of, and they can apply these same principles. There are people who don't have those severe illnesses. There are people who there are people who we would say have certain conditions, like they are sociopaths. They're narcissists. And the reason that they live their life is because they've been so brutally wounded in some way, shape, or form that they have no access to feeling shame. They live their life out in response to shame without having any access to feeling it. Does that make sense? And this is a problem, of course, because they just can kind of like cut a swath of collateral damage, and there's no appealing to anything about anything that they've done that feels wrong to them. In fact, quite the opposite. They might tell you that they're the ones who feel wronged, and that's exactly why they behave the way they do. It's everybody else to blame. At which point it becomes really important for us, once again, when I'm feeling like I'm the one who's having to care for these folks and it feels like it's not going very well, I'm still going to be asking the question, who is in my great cloud of witnesses that is helping me manage the stuff that I start to feel when I don't feel like I can be very effective for the people who aren't changing according to my timetable? Does that make sense? Yeah. I have 8:58. I'll do one more question, and then we'll stop. Yes. Digested shame particularly well, meaning that they have responded well to it, and they kind of come out on the other end in a healthy fashion? No. Meaning, I don't know of many cultures that do this very well. Like, there's a reason why it is said of in sociology, in social psychology, in social sciences, there's a reason why it is said that there are certain shame and honor cultures. that are driven so much by this notion. But I want to suggest, like, those cultures were made up of human beings that have brains. And shame does not begin in some abstract thing called a culture. Right? Shame begins in the context of real neurobiological experience of real human beings. And to the degree that shame is systematized, whether that system is, let's say, in a family, or it's in a church, or it's in a school, or it's a community, or it's an entire nation, to the degree that there are more brains that are living in accordance with the way shame and evil would have us live, the harder it will be to move it. Right? It's hard to move that. But you will recognize that Scripture is replete with references wherein which the notion of sin is frequently coupled with the notion of shame. Also guilt. But, and this one last thing about shame and the difference between those two things, shame and guilt. Right? So we said that shame can emerge as early as 15 to 18 months of age. It's early and often, and we practice it really well. For guilt to emerge, the thing that we call guilt, remember, these words, shame and guilt, they're words. They're symbols that represent neurobiological and relational realities. We could have called it anything else we want to. But the thing, for instance, that we call guilt that a person experiences doesn't typically tend to emerge in children until they're somewhere between the ages of about 3 and 5 years of age. And the reason has a lot to do, it's assumed, the reason has a lot to do with the fact that the thing that we call guilt is this sense of I feel bad, I've done something bad, and this thing that I've done bad is affecting my relationship with my mom, my dad, my teacher, my friend, my whoever, right? It requires my awareness of feeling something associated with the thing that I've done, and that that thing has actually fractured or interrupted a relationship with someone else that matters to me. If I'm 18 months of age, I don't have any sense of any of that. My brain is not old enough yet to know that there is necessarily a me and a you. Everything is just me, right? And everything that I want is because I want it. Like, you know, the nerve of parents telling a two-year-old to share with their friend. Like, come on. I have no idea what this concept is, share. Like, over my dead body. But here's the thing. With guilt, with this particular experience, if a kid has an event in which they feel guilty, this thing like I've done something bad, I've fractured this relationship, if it happens between them and a relationship that they trust, right, with somebody that they love and who loves them, their first typical response is to turn toward that person to say that they are sorry in order for them to repair the rupture. With shame, this never happens. The primitive nature of shame is such that even when we sense and feel it, the thing that we do automatically is turn away. Because the act of turning toward you actually exacerbates the very feeling of shame that I have, and I anticipate this, which is part of why I resist turning toward you, despite the fact that needing you is the number one thing that is important for my brain. Like, I need you more than I need anything else on the planet. The problem with shame is I need you to come find me. And I want to suggest that this is exactly what God has done in Jesus. And with that, I will say you've been a lovely audience. Thank you for coming. And can I pray for you? And help me again with the gentleman's name. Jason. Big guy, right? I've seen a picture, like big in like multiple ways. So I don't know if the plan was to pray and we're done, but I'm going to pray and then we can be done or whatever because it's bewitching hour here, right? So let's pray together. Wow, Holy Trinity, have mercy on us. Have mercy on our grief, on the grief of this community, on the grief of Jason's family, And you know, God, I want so badly for you to come in a palpable, living, breathing, felt, embodied way into this community in the next 24 hours on the way home from this space. While people are still sitting in their chairs, Spirit, I want you to move in such a way that does not deny this horrible thing, but reminds us that you do not ever leave us alone. And in the coming moments and hours and sleepless nights and grief-stricken days, I want you to find them. I want you to meet them. I want you to bring Jason to their memory and remind them that you have him and you have them. And bring them to each other shamelessly, that they may remind each other that even in their grief, they are not alone, that you are with us, that you never leave or forsake us. And we look for the resurrection to remind us of Jason's life and the vitality that he brought to this community and to those with whom he worked and lived and breathed. And in so doing, say to evil, that the gates of hell will not stand against you. Take us out of this place in comfort and confidence, in the power of your Spirit and in the name of your Son, Jesus, in whom we pray. Amen.